Welcome to New Books and Popular Music, a channel of the New Books Network. I'm your host, Matt Smith-Larman. In this episode, I talk with James Green, Jr. about his book, This Music Leaves Stains, The Complete Story of the Misfits, published in 2013 by the Scarecrow Press. Like many teenagers in northeastern New Jersey's Bergen County, Glenn Anzalone made regular trips into New York City. It is there that this horror movie and comic book-obsessed artist, like so many of his generation, it was the 1970s, discovered punk rock a la the Ramones. Soon enough, he had a band of his own, rechristening himself Glenn Danzig, and bringing in brothers Gerald, a.k.a. Jerry Only, and Paul, a.k.a. Doyle, Kaiafa, as well as a rotating cast of players including, at various times, Black Flag veterans Robo and Dez Cadena. It is the lineup of Danzig, Jerry, Doyle, and drummer Arthur Googie that made Walk Among Us, generally considered to be a classic in the genre of hardcore horror rock. There were numerous conflicts among the band members in the 1980s and 90s, leading to numerous changes in the lineup. Danzig, of course, left the band in 1983 to form Samhain, and the more commercially successful band sporting his own name, Danzig. In the mid-90s, after winning the rights to the name Misfits from Danzig, Jerry Only and Doyle, rechristened Doyle Wolfgang von Frankenstein, reformed the band, added a couple new players, and performed for the next 5 years, at which point brothers Jerry and Doyle had a falling out of their own, the result of which was Doyle leaving the band. The current lineup consists of Jerry Only on bass and vocals, Black Flag alum Dez Cadena on guitar, and Eric Chupacabra Arce on the skins. All of this, of course, and more, I learned by reading James Green Jr.'s band history. James Green Jr. lives in Brooklyn, New York. However, I reached him in Deltona, Florida for this interview. Hello, James, and welcome to New Books in Popular Music.
Thank you, Matthew. I'm thrilled to be here.
Great. Why don't we start first with a little biography? Tell us a little bit about who you are, where you grew up, that kind of thing, please.
Okay, great. Well, my name is James Green Jr. I was born and raised in a small Connecticut town called Ridgefield, which is very bucolic and quaint and fantastic to live in if you're an adult, but kind of boring if you're a kid. And I think that's what spurned my interest in the odd and the weird, because there wasn't much of it there. And I've been a freelance writer for, I guess, 7 or 8 years now. And this Misfits book is my most visible and noted accomplishment so far. So that's and I worked at Taco Bell for 2 years in college. I feel that's important to point out.
Where did you go to college?
I went to college at the University of Central Florida, beautiful Orlando, and not too many famous alums. Cheryl Hines from Curb Your Enthusiasm went there, and actually I take that back. The guys who made the Blair Witch Project, they made it. They were at UCF or shortly after graduating UCF, they made it, I believe.
Uh-huh. What do you mean that you have an interest in the weird? What does that mean, James?
Well, I mean, I wrote a book about the Misfits, who, despite being an enormously popular punk band, definitely aren't on the same level as the Ramones or the Clash. And it means that I'm drawn to anything, you know, like my favorite TV shows of all time are stuff like Space Ghost Coast to Coast, Mr. Show. Like, I don't like anything. Like, yeah, everyone's obsessed with Mad Men or Breaking Bad. I can't watch shows like that. I can't. Like fictionalized drama, stuff like that, just does, it seems like the most rote, uninteresting thing in the world to me. You know, and I guess growing up, you know, it's a very, there were a lot of deadheads where I grew up. So that kind of pushed me to, you know, harder music or, you know, things that were more extreme and, you know, just things like, you know, I mean, certainly there are a lot of things I like that are very popular in mainstream. I'm not, you know, some complete separatist, but yeah, for the most part, I'm more interested in things that haven't gotten a lot of attention or things that are purposely, not molded to be like, digestible for mass audiences.
So then tell us, James, why specifically did you write a book about the Misfits, and how did it come about?
Well, it came about because there were a couple other books that I had tried to write. Like in 2001, 2002, I tried to put together a book about the Dead Kennedys, and then shortly after that, I was working on something about Star Wars fan culture and how it was like really, like, because of the prequels, it was really breaking off into weird places. Those projects didn't go anywhere. And my only goal in life has always been to get a book published. And, I got a pretty all right freelance career going, for a while. And then, in 2011, I was writing for Crawdaddy, the website / magazine, and I lost my job. Crawdaddy folded, and then I just kind of realized, I think now is the time to buckle down on writing a book, while I am completely unemployed and have no obligations. And I realized, you know what? No one's written a book about the Misfits, which is bizarre because, you know, every day you see, and I'm not putting down these artists at all further, but I'm saying, like, you see, like, well, there have been like 8 books on Morrissey. There have been how many books on Gram Parsons or whoever, and no one's written about the Misfits. And, you know, their singer was like a top 40 artist for a hot second. And, you know, they influenced Metallica and Guns N' Roses and all these other people. Why hasn't this been done yet? And I've been a fan of theirs for so long. At that point, I said, I'm just going to try and do this and see where it goes. And I somehow got it published.
Fabulous. And you've seen them live, probably.
I have, yes. I saw them multiple times on the reunion tour in the mid-90s. I'm only 34. I was just 4 years old when the original band broke up, so wasn't going to a lot of punk shows as a toddler. but I definitely, I saw them. The first time I saw them was 1997, when they were touring with Marky Ramone and the Intruders. And, that was like, you know, one of those, it seems like a lot of times, at least in my experiences, like there would rarely be like a concert package where it was like, okay, there's 2 pretty solid things happening here. And I was like, Marky Ramone and the Intruders are pretty great. And, you know, these Misfits guys, they seem pretty wild. I'm sure that'll be something nutty. And it was. Before I had come to the recording shortly before that, like the original recordings. And, I was kind of like, you know, this is fascinating how this exists and how this is a whole world that it's just kind of compartmentalized upon itself, but so many people are into it. It just seemed like another weird, this totally new subset of punk culture. I just fell into it and didn't really look back. There were even, you know, people want to, I mean, obviously people have differing opinions about the reunion versus the original band, but I thought that the reunion band was great, certainly great live, and I think the records they made were pretty great. So, I ended up seeing them about 4 or 5 times after that.
Mm-hmm. Fabulous. So let's get to the book now. Now that we know a little bit about you, James. Talk about Lodi, New Jersey.
Lodi, New Jersey.
Although I imagine the marijuana smokers probably say Lodi once in a while.
Of course, because, you know, the Slick Rick hit Lodi Dodi. It's confused a generation, but that's okay because Slick Rick is great.
Is he from Lodi too?
No. He isn't. He was born in England, actually. Slick Rick.
Okay.
He's really fancy. He's a fancy guy. But no, Lodi. It's pronounced Lodi.
Lodi.
Yeah, it's pretty suburban, regular, run-of-the-mill, leave-it-to-beaver style New Jersey town. It was, you know, one of the many places in America that benefited from the post-World War II boom. You know, mostly blue collar, but, you know, not comparable to like an Allentown. It's your basic average, American town. You can't imagine, you really can't imagine anything that odd occurring there. It's not like, you know, it seems like a safe, certainly fine place to raise a family. And I mean, granted, there are, you know, some certain, like, you know, whatever you want to make of the mob connections there. But I feel like that maybe has been a little enhanced or, like exaggerated because of the Sopranos. But yeah, you know, it's a fine place to be. I visited it several times and, it's not that your first inclination upon visiting isn't, oh, I bet Glenn Danzig grew up here.
Mm-hmm. Tell us about Glenn Danzig growing up, please.
Well, don't mind if I do. Glenn was, he was the younger, but not the youngest of four brothers. And, you know, his father was a TV repairman. Mother was, worked in a department store, but was mainly a stay-at-home mom. Mother nurtured his interests in art and music, and, nothing in his early life, that we know of that would have spurned such an interest in the occult or doom and gloom. He was just attracted to it. You know, that's one of the big things is people ask all the time, what made Glenn Danzig, Glenn Danzig? Like there's some kind of event, you know, and it just isn't. It's just he, for whatever reason, he had an interest in the more macabre, such is often the case. You know, there isn't always one thing to point to. By all accounts, it was a very normal, you know, there wasn't like a violent parent. There wasn't like some tragedy. Mm-hmm. Just, you know, your normal everyday upbringing as far as anybody knows.
As far as anybody knows, you mentioned a few things like the movie The Night of the Living Dead as mm-hmm. an influence.
Oh, certainly. Yeah. Yeah. And I think that's another thing. Like, I mean, I don't think Glenn Danzig is like an isolated incident. I'm sure there were tons of kids, tons of young adults and teenagers who were like, you know, living in this weird, you know, sort of, like I said, Leave it to Beaver, Father Knows Best society that began fragmenting in the 60s because not just of things like Vietnam and like musical changes, but also because, you know, like underground cinema like Night of the Living Dead and things like that kind of bubbling up to the surface before the ratings board really got in place, or you know, when you know the movie industry was much less controlled and ham-fisted. Night of the Living Dead was such a departure from even the normal horror movies that Hollywood was pumping out. It was really a total tone shift, and I think it struck a lot of people. It's still, you know, it's still to this day, you know, there are people who that's the all time. Than the ground zero for everything.
For everything.
Yeah. Well, for certain people say there, you know, whereas Danzig might not have one thing in his life where he can say this changed me. I mean, you go to a horror convention or Comic-Con or something and everyone says, oh, I saw this movie and it made me look at things this way. And there's certainly tons of people who say Night of the Living Dead changed the way I thought about things.
So he lived up there in Lodi, but this is the 1970s, right? Like the mid 70s.
Yeah, when he started getting into music, like performing. Yeah.
So like a lot of teenagers of his generation and that geographical area, for entertainment, he went down to New York City, right?
Yeah, that's true. But I want to point out that like by the mid 70s, Glenn was already in his 20s. He wasn't a teenager. Okay. But yeah, of course, like anybody in the New York City radius, the outlying areas, yeah, he would go into New York and see shows and experience the whole different, you know, the different planet that New York City's always been. Yeah, and he was, you know, stuff like the Velvet Underground. The New York scene influenced him, but also the heavy metal that was coming in. Like, he always points to Black Sabbath. Well, that's like one of the first things he mentions. And it's clear when you look at it now, it's like, oh, of course, Danzig is kind of the Misfits and everything he's done since has kind of been like a combination of Black Sabbath and like Velvet Underground, Ramonesy type of things. But yeah, he started going to the city and, thinking like, you know, I want to start performing, because there weren't any, he didn't have any other, have as much drive to do other things.
He was a visual artist, like a painter too, though, right? Or a drawer?
He drew. He wanted to, like, he did comic book drawings, and he submitted some stuff to Marvel, and mm-hmm. he took some classes on comic book drawing and stuff. But the passion for singing and music was greater.
And what was going on as well as Black Sabbath, of course, was like punk rock. You said the Ramones, and you know that was. Mm-hmm. I'm sure that was this new freedom for rock and roll bands.
Yeah.
What you can do.
Yeah, and, certainly.
Certainly. What about now?
And then, see, I feel like you're teasing me there.
No, I'm not teasing you. We're agreeing.
Okay.
Now there's a lot of, so Glenn is the beginning of the book. Mm-hmm. Now there's lots and lots of other characters that come and go from the Misfits. I'm not sure which ones you want to focus on. For me, I suppose the focus should be on Jerry and Doyle and how they come to the band.
Yeah.
But if you want to preface that with the a year or two before they get in the band, you can.
Yeah, sure. I mean, the Misfits in terms of members was kind of like Saturday Night Live, like hard to keep track of who's on it and who's not. The Misfits began when like Glenn heard, I think I might get this backwards, but it was when Glenn met Jerry through Manny Martinez, the drummer, and they were all kind of in the neighborhood, and they had never really met before, but one day they ran across each other, and the conversation between Glenn and Jerry was something of like, oh, you know, you're into that punk rock stuff. He's like, yeah, you know, I like Generation X and the Damned. Oh, I like those bands too. Like, you know, and Jerry had just received a bass guitar as a Christmas gift. And they said, well, let's get together and try to do some stuff. And so they started as a trio and they put out one single and they played some shows with Glenn singing and playing electric piano with Jerry on bass and Manny playing drums. But then, obvious, and I apologize for a writer. I don't have a large vocabulary. They said, this isn't aggressive enough. So Jerry's friend, Frank Licata, who took the name Franche Coma, he joined up as the guitar player. And then Manny left, and then another mutual friend, Mr. Jim, came in to play drums. And that's really that lineup of Glenn, Jerry, Frank, and Mr. Jim was really where sort of the big step forward. That was the lineup that recorded Static Age, and where the Misfits sound, as people generally know it, began, clicked as this kind of brooding, like stark take on the Ramones and the Heartbreakers and the New York stuff like that. And yeah, it wasn't until, you know, then they had another lineup change, like Frank and Mr. Jim left, and then Bobby Steele and on guitar and Joey Image on drums came in, and they were there for a couple years, year or two, and that was the lineup that really started a big groundswell in New York. They were playing like Max's Kansas City and CBGBs and stuff, and that's when the band kind of started kicking up some dust. And the way Jerry tells it is he always wanted his younger brother Doyle whose real name is Paul, to play guitar in the band, because they thought it would look good, because he's a big, young, strapping Italian lad, and he would look cool and sexy. And, you know, he did when he joined the band in 80 or 81. Yeah, he did. He absolutely did. That's definitely what pushed their image to the iconic status when it became like, you know, and over this time period, they, of course, you know, began, decided, you know what, there are no punk rockers who are really like muscle bound and physically fit. Like, let's go with that as our image. And by the time Doyle joined, it was like Danzig was this muscular. So like, you know, he was short, but he was obviously very powerful looking. And then Geryon Doyle or like a head above him on either side. Very, you know, again, like always playing with their shirts off and like not intentionally flexing, but obviously playing with a lot of vigor. And yeah, it was really a striking thing compared to, you know, Joey Ramone, who was, you know, just this, like, he was kind of had the dimensions of a coat hanger. Or, you know, most of the other punk bands are just like, you know, skinny 17-year-old white kids who didn't strike a physically imposing demeanor. And that, I think that obviously helped push the Misfits music was already very forceful, and that reinforced it, that image.
I think the Misfits are interesting in the sense of they are always so obviously intentional, and this, I don't know, I often think of it, they're kind of part of the second wave of punk, some kind it's called hardcore, you know, where the image a lot of bands at that time tried to portray was of not having an image, like we're the same when we're off stage, when we're on stage,
yeah,
and you know, we're not muscly, we're not going to go, you know, get physically fit just so we look good to the fans. But then here are the Misfits, who are, you know, so obviously over the top with all of this.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah, sure. And what's interesting is that, you know, you look at the Misfits, and they did garner a lot of comparisons to Kiss. Sometimes positively, sometimes like as an insult. But that would later become this, you know, when the band originally broke up, like one of Danzig's many reasons as to why he no longer got along with Jerry and Doyle was that he hurled the accusation that they didn't live the lifestyle. They weren't wearing their stage clothes off stage, and he apparently was, and they weren't committed to this grave robbing, corpse beating lifestyle that Danzig wants us all to believe he does. You know, and that it definitely blurs it, you know, kind of blurs the line. Like, I don't think Danzig is like, you know, feasting on entrails when he's off stage, but I know he's probably also not like sitting around in a t-shirt that says like I went to the Bahamas and all I got was this lousy t-shirt and like sipping a Mai Tai. You know, it's definitely a very odd, there's, you know, the whole thing is kind of blurry. It's not like a Gene Simmons thing where on stage she's dressed like the monster and off stage she's in an Armani suit.
And then that's funny because later on in the book, you know, we can jump around. That's okay. And I actually looked these up on the internet after you wrote about them. You know, there's this image of Danzig. I don't know where he is, living in L.A. or whatever, and carrying cat litter, right?
Yeah,
exactly. And how for most celebrities, you know, why would this be a big deal? But this became a big deal, and where he gets punched and he falls down. That other one. And those are all over the internet. You're right.
Yeah, because he spent so many years perpetuating this idea that, like, he's no nonsense. The buck stops here. Everything you see is what you get. I'm a Jeet Kune Do master, and I'm into the occult, and you know, I just live this lifestyle. And it's like, yeah, but you're also like a weightlifter from New Jersey, and you know, you're not, and it's too easy for people to be like, oh, well, you know, and he's wearing a Danzig shirt while he's buying kitty litter. So it's like, you know.
You love kitties.
Yeah. So what? But of course, like, he's human. He's not an alien. Like, he's not. I mean, you know, this has been in the news recently, and I'm certainly not saying that Glenn Danzig is in the same ballpark as J.D. Salinger, but all this stuff is coming out about Salinger's private life and how, like, oh my God, he watched the Mary Tyler Moore Show. How could he? That, like, lowers him in our eyes, and it's like, you know, he's just a guy. Like,
right.
Well, you know, he's not going to be, like, poignant and poetic every moment of his life. Like, he's got bills to pay, he's got TV to watch, you know. So the only person I can think of who has really succeeded in doing in keeping photos of themselves out of the press like that, where they're buying boring household items, is Morrissey, who I mentioned earlier. Like, he's really committed to the Morrissey thing, and I think that would be the only thing that would be more shocking, is if, you know, we saw him walking out of a grocery store with, like, poppycock or Cookie Crisp. You know, that would be shocking.
There's a few. I think Prince has done a pretty good job at it, too.
That's true. But that Chappelle Show skit really, that decimated, you know, where it's like, oh, Prince eats pancakes like the rest of us commoners. Yeah.
So let's get back to the band.
Okay.
So we've kind of got the classic lineup of them secured, except for the Googie, right?
When just before Doyle joined, Googie came in. But I want to make sure that, like, I think that each lineup to itself is classic. Like, they all did something unique and worthy of, like, saying that this is classic. Like, I feel that the Static Age line, like, you know, even as a trio, like, that the single that Jerry, Manny, and Glenn recorded together, Cough Cool, is, I mean, it's not like anything else I've ever heard. It's like it's like this goth punk keyboard thing, you know, and the, like, Glenn's vocals are that may be one of the, like, the way they recorded his vocals on that are just, like, amazing. It just, you feel everything. And, like, the Static Age as an album, as I don't think they really topped it. It's just this perfect, like, it really feels like you're being drawn into this murky world of violence and punk. But the songwriting is also incredible. Like, every one of those songs, if they weren't about, like, pitchforking babies, it could be on the radio. You know, and the singles that they did with Bobby Steele and Joey Image are, like, they injected more humor, more fun into, like, you know, Horror Business and Night of the Living Dead are fun songs. They're still, like, rough, and they're still, like, violent, but they're more, like, there's a more relaxed, like, kind of, you know, elbow you in the ribs type of feel to it. But certainly, you know, the Misfits didn't really begin touring as heavily as they did until Doyle and Googie got in the band. I mean, I'm talking nationwide. So that's where that is often the starting point for most people, where, like Arthur Googie, this drummer who had only played for, like, a couple months in a band before joining the Misfits, and his lack of, like, percussive finesse, you might say, is evident, but it also really helped the songs stay, it really, like, underlined how, like, the brutality of Danzig's lyrics or Doyle's guitar playing. And, you know, Doyle himself wasn't that accomplished a guitar player, but that, I think, it served the themes that they were going with.
So when, and you're right, I mean, but outside of the people that have, like yourself, maybe, that are pretty hardcore fans of the band, you know, most of us, and maybe it's just my age and when I was introduced to the band, but the Walk Among Us as the album and that lineup and their touring around that, that seems to be the one that's frozen in our culture over time, is that era.
Yeah, certainly. And that's because it's the Walk Among Us is the album that has, it's existed the longest. You know, Static Age wasn't released in full until 1997, and like Walk Among Us was the first piece of Misfits like most people got a hold of, and it, you know, it was reissued on compact disc in the 80s, and that around the time that, you know, Metallica covered some of their songs on that Garage Days EP, or like the 598 Garage thing. Yeah, and like Walk Among Us is a great, great album, and there's like some of their best songs are on that. Like, and they, I think as a Danzig's songwriting really tightened up for Walk Among Us. I think it's only the only issue with it is the like the production or the mixing is really flat, and there isn't much depth to the music. There isn't the same weight that you hear on Static Age or even on Earth AD. I think that's its only drawback. But yeah, certainly, and that's when also, like I said, their image was, you know, the cover of that record is them standing in front of like that giant bat monster, and there's UFOs, and you know, they've literally pasted themselves into a horror movie. So it really, it's like, yeah, you know, this is totally on the nose. We get it. You're the Misfits, violent world. Okay, let's go with this. And yeah, and also, yeah, all the melodies are very, everything on Walk Among Us you can sing along to. So it's very, it's almost like a Broadway experience.
Either a Broadway experience or more of an English kind of, you know, oi band kind of soccer football chant kind of song.
Yeah, exactly. It, you know, any chanting in any region, it's it's, yeah, it's definitely speaks to that. And I think because there are, they ramp that also adds the sense of community of like, we can sing along. It's okay for us to sing along to this. I think with their other albums, there was a sense that you were always on the other side, that you were always just kind of looking in and not that. Walk Among Us is definitely a very inviting record.
I have my Walk Among Us story is this, that I was in high school when it came out, and I had this friend, Tom, and Tom owned the record.
Mm-hmm.
Tom lent it to my other friend, Chris.
Mm-hmm.
Chris's mom read the lyrics, and she literally destroyed it. It was a vinyl EP. She literally smashed it to pieces after reading the lyrics.
Well, you know, it's not for everybody.
No, it wasn't for Chris's mom, apparently.
No.
They were like a Black Sabbath of hardcore there for a while. Kind of evil.
Yeah, I mean, certainly. Listen, there's, you know, my mother certainly was not pleased when, you know, I had a giant poster that was a recreation of the Bullet single where Kennedy's head is being, they took they did a Liechtenstein print of Kennedy in the Cadillac and then like painted blood behind his head. And, you know, my mom was like, you know, I don't know, listen, I'm pretty liberal, but, what's up with this? And yeah, their Danzig lyrics are intense. But you have to go. Sometimes someone has to force you to go there. Sometimes you can't, you know, and his, as jokey as a lot of the songs are, there are a lot of passages in the lyrics that are like, wow, this makes me think this is, you know, really beautiful writing. And what does this mean? And, yeah, I think it's a good balance there.
And that came out on Ruby Records, which is on the West Coast. How did they get in contact with Ruby Records? How'd that work out?
Yeah, well, there's differing stories. The Chris Jardins, whose name I'm sure I butchered, was the Ruby. He was the guy working at Ruby. He was also in the Flesh Eaters. And he says, the way he remembers it, he's not sure if he got in touch with Danzig or if Danzig called him, but originally they contacted because Danzig wanted to take an ad out in Slash magazine, and Slash was the parent company of Ruby. And, they somehow got to talking, and they're like, yeah, you should do a one record contract with us. And in an unusual turn of events, Danzig and the Misfits, who are usually pretty fierce and cagey about doing everything themselves, said, yeah, why not? I think maybe because they could see that Slash and Ruby were, you know, they were managing to really blow the germs up in a certain way. And they also had Fear and X. And I think they probably just felt like, well, this label is more attuned to the type of things we're doing than, say, you know, because the other, like, who else was there that was signing punk bands at the time, like Sire Records? Mm-hmm. They were a little more pop oriented. You know, they're just, I think it was probably, and they felt like, I imagine they felt like, this hasn't really ever been explained too thoroughly, but it seems like they're like, yeah, let's take a chance because these people seem to have the resources and they're on a hot streak. So why not?
And they had Plan 9 Records as theirs, right?
Yeah. That was the Danzig's record label, the Misfits record label. Yeah.
And they released those early singles and such were on that.
Yeah. Everything featuring Glenn Danzig singing through most of Samhain, I think all of Samhain was released, except, I don't think Final Descent. Let's say the majority. There was a big span where everything was on Plan 9 Records, and that of course was, like Plan 9 was, I don't know how you want to, forced into defunct status because of the lawsuit later on. But yeah, all those, if you find original copies of the records, they all have that really cool Plan 9 logo that's done like the Sex Pistols logo.
Mm-hmm. The Misfits were very image conscious, as we've already mentioned.
But yes.
And since you brought up the logo, you could talk about the most famous Misfits logo, the skull.
The Crimson Ghost, yeah.
The Crimson Ghost, yeah.
Crimson Ghost, not actually crimson, actually white, and even in the Crimson Ghost is a character from a 1940s movie serial. This is back when, you know, before television, and, you know, they could make short little movies and people would pay money to go see them and then come back the next week and pay more money. Pretty good racket. Yeah, there was a Republic Pictures created this detective noir series about the Crimson Ghost, who was a criminal mastermind who wore this intense, very striking skull mask. And, you know, if you watch the, like, you see it now and you associate, you know, the Jerry and Glenn found an old poster for the Crimson Ghost in the 70s and said, hey, we should start using this thing. And lucky for them, like, the copyright had lapsed at that point, or whoever owned it was like a holding company in Oklahoma or whatever. And there was no way they were going to get in serious trouble because of they were just some, you know, schmo punk band at the time. And they had no idea it was going to be this huge thing later. But what's funny is you look at the Crimson Ghost now, most people associate it with Danzig's voice and like that powerful Jim Morrison type of thing. But if you watch the original Crimson Ghost serials, he talks with this kind of weird regular, like, I'm the Crimson Ghost and I'm going to get you. It's like this weird, like Eddie Murphy doing the white guy voice. So it's really like jarring. But yeah, it was in terms of, like they couldn't have picked a more perfect, object to represent their, the striking nature of their music.
And it persists. I mean, I teach college and I have, you know, it's one of those things where I have an 18-year-old student will wear a shirt with it on it, and they may have never even listened to the Misfits, but they'll have the Crimson Ghost on their shirt.
Oh, sure. It's endured way beyond the band. Like, you know, it's a fashion accessory now.
It is a fashion accessory.
Even Justin Bieber has been seen wearing the Crimson Ghost.
Oh, my gosh. Maybe he'll be their next singer.
I would welcome that. I think that would be interesting. I mean, anything that has the potential to be an awful car crash, I endorse.
Yeah. So let's move on, because there's a lot of band after Walk Among Us. There's a lot of band, and I don't even know where you want to start. One of the things I'm interested in is how did the connection between how is it that Danzig ends up leaving the band? I guess.
I think you could shovel it all under that helpful term creative differences, but I think there were mainly lifestyle differences. I think it was, a case of when the Misfits began, they were dedicated to doing this thing called the Misfits, but they didn't necessarily see that it could be like a full-time thing or see that they could make their life out of this band. And I think by 1983, when they broke up, I think Jerry and Doyle were still working at their father's machine shop. They were, they had 9-to-5 jobs, and the Misfits, the way they saw it, it was just like this thing that was eating up money and it wasn't really getting anywhere. And something that a lot of people say from that time, when I interviewed Frank Licata, he definitely stressed the point. He's like, I feel stupid for leaving the band. I couldn't like dance. Like Glenn was always saying, like, this is going to be we can really go places. And he's like, I just couldn't see it. I didn't have that foresight. And I think the same thing can be said for Jerry and Doyle, is that they said, you know, we've done a few tours. We're losing money. We don't seem to be getting any more popular or anything. And I think, they were getting more into heavy metal and stuff. And, Danzig wanted to keep things pure and said, no, we need to not change our style. And we need to just let things happen organically, and we need to move forward because this could happen if we just put more time into it. And I think that, you know, the kind of frustrations that people have when they're in their 20s and everybody wants to say that their way is right and they have difficulty compromising. And unfortunately, that final show in October of 1983 in Detroit, for a year or so before that, Robo from Black Flag had been their drummer, and he left because he was tired of living with Danzig. He couldn't deal with it. They weren't getting along. And then they had this Halloween show, and they had a tour. They were supposed to do a tour after that of Germany. And, Dan and Jerry and Doyle are like, well, why don't we just ask Arthur Googie to come back? And he knows all the songs. We don't have time to teach anybody else the songs. And Danzig said, I don't want to work with Arthur Googie again. So let me just find somebody. So he got, Brian Keats, who was drumming. He played with Genocide. He played with Verbal Abuse. Not like, it's often characterized as like Danzig just picked some kid off the street, but like, no, the guy, Brian played with these great, like, Verbal Abuse is considered one of the greatest, like, hardcore bands of all time, and Genocide is nothing to sneeze at either. He was an accomplished drummer. Unfortunately, he didn't have enough time to practice with Jerry and Doyle and Glenn because of Jerry and Doyle's work schedule. And then they get out to Detroit. Brian Keats is nervous. He drinks a little too much. He messes up a couple of the songs, and Doyle just kicks him off stage, and the drummer from the Necros played the rest of the show. And I think it was just one of those frustrating situations that if there wasn't all this other pressure, if they hadn't been doing the band for that long to that point, maybe they could have resolved it. But I think it was an easy place for them all to check out and say, let's go our separate ways because it's too frustrating. Mm-hmm.
So from that point, even before that, had Danzig already done something solo?
Yeah. He hit in 1981. He put out a solo single, the "Who Killed Marilyn" single, where he played all the instruments. Because he said the Misfits weren't doing anything, or they didn't want to do the song, and so he did it himself. And before the Misfits broke up, he was investigating putting together some kind of group, like some kind of super group with people from Minor Threat and from Youth Brigade, kind of like the beginnings of Sam Hain, because he kind of felt like he could see that the Misfits were going to hit a wall soon, but there was nothing like there was no major step out of the band. He was still committed to being in the Misfits. Mm-hmm.
But then they break up, and of course, Glenn has the most, I guess, commercial success anyway for a while, especially when he has the band Simply Danzig, right?
And before leaping to Danzig, though, right from the after the Misfits, he forms Samhain, which, granted, while Samhain has not, I think for a lot of people, the jury's still out on Samhain. I think they're great. They did something that was a little bit different and not different than the Misfits and different from Danzig, not very, a little more, a little more difficult, just more goth, a little more, a little darker than anything else. But it kept, they toured all that time and put out records, and they kept Danzig and his voice and his image and his music out there in the underground. And that really, that made the connection to Danzig in 1988 when he met Rick Rubin, and Rick Rubin said, "Hey, you're great. Your band, maybe not so great. Let's get some ringers." And they did, and that was the transformation into Danzig, the band.
So the Misfits as a band don't play for a while at this point. They're kind of broken up.
Oh, no, they're totally broken up.
They're completely broken up.
Jerry and Doyle retreat to the wilds in New Jersey, and they don't do anything. They don't put a band together until 1987, 88. And it's not a band connected to the Misfits at all. It's this weird heavy metal project called Christ the Conqueror that had these strange biblical overtones/undertones. And there was nothing, and you read interviews from Jerry around that time, and based on things that I've researched and heard, his whole attitude was like, "I don't care about the Misfits. Like, I don't care about Glenn Danzig. None of this matters to me. I just want to do this thing, this Christ the Conqueror stuff." But, and I think that would have been the end of it had Metallica not covered those one or two Misfit songs on that EP, when they were on this, Metallica was on this inexplicable rise to being the most popular heavy metal band in America. We're just going to cover some Misfit songs. And suddenly this band from New Jersey, who certainly had an underground popularity, but maybe would not have been thrust to the levels they were had Metallica latched onto them. I think, that's something I think is kind of up for debate, because as culture moves forward and we unearth more and more artifacts from our past, there's more attention given to things that otherwise, like 10 years ago or 15 years ago, would have been forgotten or, people wouldn't care about. Like, I feel like there are more Pere Ubu fans today than there were 15 years ago. there are certainly, there are more, like, Zugs Rift, I don't know how to pronounce that. What obviously at that point in time, Metallica is selling like hotcakes, and they've got songs that Glenn and Jerry and all those people created, put together. And so that became like, kind of like, okay, now the Misfits are this viable commercial entity to some extent. So what happens now?
And what happens now is what? Jerry decides he wants to put the Misfits back together?
I think the first impetus was, just that Jerry wanted to make sure that he and the other Misfits got any money that they were owed from, and Danzig had also put out without their consent before this. I should mention there had been a couple of releases like Legacy of Brutality that Danzig released where he didn't credit. There was Legacy of Brutality was a compilation of Misfits recordings where Danzig he didn't credit any of the other Misfits, and he recorded over much of the original guitars and bass and stuff. And I think the suit initially was Jerry and the other Misfits wanting to make sure that they got the credit and they got whatever monies they were owed. But then at some point it was decided, like, you know what, let's see if we can get some kind of performing rights to the Misfits name. And they did. They did. The settlement, that was sort of the trade-off, because Danzig is still the majority, if not the entire, copyright holder for the original Misfits material. And everything is kind of, things aren't necessarily split evenly, possibly because there are so many hands in the pot, but Jerry does have the performing rights to the Misfits, and he is allowed to go out and play as many shows as he wants as the Misfits. I can't say, as far as I know, I think maybe it was a situation where Jerry decided, the Christ the Conqueror isn't really happening. Maybe I'm not as divorced from the Misfits as I thought. And if there's a potential to make the fans happy and also make a little money, go out there and like maybe rehabilitate my image or the band's image, like let's go for it, And I think, like a lot of reunions, people are like, what? Like, this is, mm-hmm. How is this happening? Why isn't this thing in the past? But, it happened, and I don't think it was a bad thing. I mean, I would have not come to the Misfits initially had it not been for the reunion. I wouldn't really have been aware of them. And the reunion with Michael Graves and Dr. Chud and Doyle and Jerry was, they were a great unit unto themselves.
Mm-hmm. What is the connection between the Misfits and Black Flag anyway? How could they have Robo and then Dez plays with them?
Well, I think, if you look back, Black Flag is the only band that the Misfits felt weren't like shitting on them or weren't like phonies. It seems like every other band, people are like, oh, what do you think of the Cramps? And they're like, oh, the Cramps wouldn't let us open a show, so they all suck. Or like, what do you think of this band? Ah, those guys are all gay, so they're dumb. And like, for whatever reason, and we don't think of, you don't necessarily think of Black Flag as being that, like, as unenlightened as that, as saying like, well, this band did something we don't like, so we are going to be derogatory towards them. Uh-huh. I think musically, I think the Misfits and Black Flag are very similar. They're both very powerful. They're both very cathartic. And the members got along. They had fun. They enjoyed each other. They thought they were equals at the same level. And yeah, they're Robo, the Black Flag's drummer for a long time. He ended up out of Black Flag. He got tied up in England with some visa issues, and they're like, we have to keep touring. So they just got another drummer, and Robo had nothing to do. So Henry Rollins, I think, said, hey, the Misfits are looking for a drummer. So Robo went out to New Jersey and joined the band. And, there was just always even after Robo left, left the Misfits, he stayed on good terms with Jerry and Doyle. And, that begat some kind of friendship with like Dez Cadena, the singer/guitarist from Black Flag, was living in New Jersey for a while at least in the early 90s. They're just all chummy guys. And, I think just because maybe the time and the nature of their music, what they were doing, it was easy for them to get along. Despite whatever differences you might see in their respective personalities. I mean, I think a lot of people obviously tie Henry Rollins and Glenn Danzig together, but I don't think you would say they're the same type of person. They have the same temperaments or same personality.
No, their stage characters were very similar, I guess you'd say. kind of aggressive, very, alpha male kind of.
Yeah.
Performances.
Sure.
Uh-huh. So, let's see. So this, what you're calling the reunion Misfits, along with they still have lots of alignment, but they've been going now for 15 years or so, haven't they?
An entity known as the Misfits has existed in some form, for 15 years. Like the four person reunion lineup that we know, of Michael Graves and Jerry Only, Dr. Chud and Doyle, only existed from like 95 to 2000. And then Michael Graves and Dr. Chud left, and then they became a three-piece, and just Jerry became the singer, which I think was another huge dividing point, just when people were starting to become accustomed to, like, okay, the Misfits are now Michael Graves, and this is what it is, and we're accepting it, we're taking it. Suddenly, that's over, and Jerry only singing now. And they got more, like, and for Marky Ramone was in the band for a while. He was drumming for a while. And, you know, I think it, yeah. But, and whatever you think of the lineup changes or the shifts in power, yeah, the Misfits have been at it. They have this reunion's lasted longer than the original band. So,
at one point now, Doyle's not there anymore either. Doyle, your book seems to be centered around, you know, interpersonal conflicts quite a bit. And, you know.
Well, yeah, isn't that the most interesting part of any band? Didn't the Ramones suddenly become 1,000 times more fascinating when you found out Johnny stole Joey's girlfriend? Like, what? Yeah. I mean, you know, I'm really anticipating the release of that Clash documentary about that last album they did with those like those studio guys or whatever. That's like, you know, when Joe Strummer just said the Clash is whoever I say the Clash are. Like, what are you talking about? I think the interpersonal conflicts, especially in a punk rock band that has always like done it for themselves and has always been very fierce, you know, about we are outside of the system and we're all for one and one for all. We're a band of pirates and doing our thing, and we're not going to let the music industry corrupt us. Well, guess what? You're going to get corrupted somehow or another anyway, because people are people. And, you know, that we saw that with the Dead Kennedy. Like, who thought the Dead Kennedys would ever sue each other over songwriting? Like, why? Like, that's so insane. And so, yeah, it's wild that, you know, this band that sings all these really seemingly pure songs of anger and disenfranchised, feelings becomes like another, like, well, you know, I'm the majority shareholder in the band now, so get out of my band, or, you know, like, it's like I've been doing it the longest, or, you know, whatever. Like, it becomes like rock and roll bullshit. It's also interesting because these are people many times who have nothing else to fall back on or nothing else to do. Like, you know, just they have to live their lives being an ex-misfit, or like, what are they going to do? Like, I can't speak to Doyle's skill sets. I don't know if he excels at knitting, or like maybe he's a great basketball player or something. But when you're in your mid 30s and suddenly you're out of this band, you're out of like this gravy train that you have for so long, what do you do? Where do you turn? And I think the same interest lies in, like, you know, when Michael Graves was leaving the band, what is he going to do? His career now is he's the guy who replaced Danzig, and now he's out of that band. Like, where does he go from here? You know, I think the relationships in general are just very interesting. It's interesting that everyone says, yeah, the Misfits are Glenn Danzig's band. He wrote all the songs. Danzig is the guy. But Jerry Only's been the guy. He's been the guy doing the Misfits for the past 15 years, singing Danzig songs. Like, how do you wrap your head around that?
And they've put out a couple of – hasn't Jerry Only and the Misfits put out some original music as well?
Yeah. They put – yeah, with Michael Graves, they put out American Psycho and Famous Monsters, two pretty great albums. I think it's a weird situation where – you call it the Misfits and people are going to be like, this doesn't live up to the Misfits, simply because it's being written and produced so long after the, like, things have changed so much. Like, it seems like you're selling what they created. But also, if you don't call it the Misfits, no one's going to pay attention to it. And if you just call it, like, you know, the Schmoes from New Jersey, you know, these great records are going to be lost to time, and they really are great. I think they're great. Whether you want to believe they're part of the Misfits legacy, they are. And yeah, and so there are those two, and then the most recent that Jerry Dez and the drummer from Murphy's Law, The Devil's Reign, they put out a couple years ago, maybe, yeah, what, 2011, 2012. Yeah, they released The Devil's Reign. So yeah, they've released albums. They're certainly not like, you know, those PBS specials where they trot out, you know, the Duke of Earl once a year to get his paycheck for singing Duke of Earl. You know, they're not just like this nostalgia joke. They're, uh-huh. I mean, I guess to some extent you could say they are, because Jerry is, only released like one album in the past 12 years, and he's still mainly playing songs that Glenn Danzig wrote in the 80s or the 70s, but you know, they're writing original material. They're going out there and touring and, you know, and to the same degree, like, you know, Danzig is now doing like concerts where he's playing Misfits songs and Samhain songs, and he has Doyle come on stage and play with him. So, you know, to you could apply like, well, he's becoming nostalgia too, or he's at least being nostalgic.
And now there's Black Flag and The Flag.
Don't even get me started.
Well, I think the point is that, you know, these people, like you said earlier, you know, they're really just people, and they have careers, and you know, they gotta buy kitty litter once in a while, exactly. And they gotta pay their rent.
How's Danzig gonna buy his kitty litter? You think he's gonna get by on the strength of Death Red Sabbath? Listen, people want to hear when death comes ripping. They want to hear it with Doyle. So just do a festival, deal with it, cash your check, buy your kitty litter. Yeah.
So, in your expert analysis and opinion, James, do you think? And I know they tried this once, but will there ever be a true reunion of the original Misfits, or the quote unquote classic Misfits, at least with Danzig singing?
I think that as time passes, it becomes less and less likely. I think, you know, I don't want to say never say never. I mean, Mission of Burma reunited, and they've reunited for like a few albums now. Like, hey, nobody thought that would happen. I think they're the Police reunited. I mean, that like people, that was legend. Their fighting was like, you know, they were practically a living episode of Cops, and they reunited. And I think ultimately, I think the one thing you can always say about Danzig, regardless of where he is he's very principled, and there have been opportunities in the past for him to do this. And I think that if he hasn't done it yet, it seems unlikely. Like, he's also a shrewd guy. He's not gonna, like, there's a chance, like, everyone says, oh, the original Misfits, if they got to get back together, they would make so much money. Well, you know, not necessarily. Like, you know, they'd have to be working on a certain budget, and to accommodate all the people who wanted to be involved, and like figuring out where they would play, how they would travel and all that. I think that, you know, Danzig probably sees it as like, it's the amount of money is not worth the hassle it would be behind the scenes. And you know, for the same reason, people also say, why hasn't he reunited with Chuck Biscuits and Erie Vaughn and John Christ, the three guys he made the first four Danzig records with, which I think there's no argument that those are four of the best heavy metal albums ever made, ever, ever. And people are always saying, why doesn't he reunite with those guys? Like, he doesn't want to. Yeah, he could. To him, it's not worth whatever pain in the ass it would be putting it together, dealing with it, than the paycheck, when he can just go out with guys that he's been playing with now forever how long, and just do the routine and make his money and live his life. So I think there would have to be some sort of major tragedy. Like, you know, Danzig isn't married. He doesn't have kids. So we can't say, like, if his son got leukemia. So, you know, I would be very surprised. But again, at the same time, I guess stranger things have happened. I guess.
Hey, you know, David Lee Roth has been accepted back into Van Halen, for gosh sake.
Well, I think, come on, I think that was an inevitability. I think once if you're dumb enough to piss off Sammy Hagar, I mean, come on, like that was inevitable. They couldn't even retain Gary Cherone. Like they had to get Lee Roth back.
So thanks, James, for giving me the interview. But before we leave, what are you working on now? Are you writing any books or what are you doing?
I've got another book idea in mind that I've been trying to get some preliminary work done on. I've been trying to work on that. I'm mainly doing a lot of work trying to set up the book tour for This Music Leaves Stains, which will be in November. Uh-huh. And I've got a couple. I've been working on a screenplay, Matthew. I've gone Hollywood. I'm actually sitting by a pool right now, and I'm reading Variety. the most immediate work I have is I'm writing a feature on the state of the American space program for a science magazine, which what's more punk rock than NASA?
Nothing
at all. Nothing at all. That's really it.
Okay. Well, thanks for giving us the interview, James. I appreciate your time.
Well, thank you, Matthew. It was a pleasure.
You've been listening to a conversation with James Green Jr. about his book, This Music Leaves Stains, The Complete History of the Misfits, released by the Scarecrow Press in 2013. Check back with New Books in Popular Music regularly for more interviews with authors of books about popular music. I'm your host, Matt Smith-Larman. Thanks for listening.